This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New mobile applications available for iPhone and Android. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
This KBOO program is also being brought to you in part by Portland Community College, celebrating Black History Month and welcoming journalist and civil rights activist Charlene Hunter Gault, February 28th at the Portland Art Museum. Ticket info at pcc.edu.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, new information leaked by Portland police officers contradicts the initial report on Sunday's fatal police shooting.
The chief of the LAPD says he will reopen the case that caused Christopher Dorner to resign.
And protesters disrupt a fracking wastewater plant in Ohio.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 20th, 2013. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Nia Lewis. The patient shot and killed by Portland police outside Adventist Medical Center on Sunday may not have had a gun after all. New information leaked by Portland police officers today contradicts the initial account of Sunday night's fatal police shooting. Now, police say that the mentally ill man may only have claimed to be holding a gun and may not have been armed after all. The latest reports are that he was holding a phone handset. In numerous past police shootings, police initially stated that a suspect had a gun, only to reverse that claim later. One well-known case involved the shooting of unarmed black man Aaron Campbell in 2010. In its first reports to the media in that case, police reported that Campbell was armed and had taken hostages. It was later revealed that Campbell was shot in the back when his hands were up in the air and he was complying with police instructions. Officer Ronald Frashauer killed Campbell and was fired after a lengthy investigation. But after an appeal was filed by the police union, Officer Frashauer was reinstated with back pay last October. Police say they are still investigating Sunday's shooting and have announced a press conference at 5:30 today in the Justice Center in downtown Portland.
Delays on police reforms in Portland have been announced on two separate fronts. In the lawsuit filed by the U.S. Justice Department against Portland police for excessive use of force, the judge has allowed the police union to join talks to settle the lawsuit. This will delay the timeline for a settlement to late April or early May. The judge also denied a motion by the Albina Ministerial Alliance, a community group from North Portland, to intervene in the case. Separately, the Portland City Council today voted to allow a delay in its annual report on the city's involvement in the Joint Terrorism Task Force. According to Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch, this was not the first time that the city has avoided reforming the police department.
The Independent Police Review Division was under a lot of scrutiny a few years ago, and there was a stakeholder group put together to try to see how the whole process could be improved. And in addition to that unit, which takes the complaints about police misconduct, alleged police misconduct, there's a police review board that's internal to the police, but the IPR director sits on there. And that police review board puts out reports every 6 months that say, we recommended that this should happen to such and such officer. Or they don't even say the name, Officer A. You know, we don't get the names of the officers, but they say the circumstances. They say what the proposed discipline is. But those reports don't say what the chief decided to do. Those recommendations are just that. And sometimes the chief says, oh, well, you know, I'm not going to do what you said, like he did in the case of Captain Wyatt. Instead of firing him, that five people out of six said to do, he demoted him. the stakeholder committee had recommended unanimously that the chiefs explain what the outcome is and when it, especially when it differs from what the review board said, and he said he wouldn't do it. We're hoping that that will change now. It sounds like the IPR director is interested in working with the auditor who oversees her division in changing the rules so that the chief has to make that report to the community.
That was Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch. The Portland Police Bureau's report on its involvement with the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force will be delayed until the end of March.
A number of local residents have voiced concern about the City of Portland's plan to cut down a 100-year-old sequoia tree tomorrow in Pier Park. The city says that cutting this tree is necessary to complete the North Portland Greenway Trail. The 10.4-mile multi-use trail will connect the East Bank Esplanade at the Steel Bridge to Kelly Point Park in North Portland. The trail route will include a bridge over railroad tracks to connect Pier Park and Chimney Park in St. John's. Portland Parks and Recreation says removing the tree is the plan with the least impact. Other plans would have involved removing a cluster of trees. The city says they will plant roughly 30 new trees in Chimney Park in place of the giant sequoia to be cut down. They plan to repurpose the downed tree as logs and benches in a nature play area at Westmoreland Park. The project advisory committee is responsible for engaging the public and giving feedback to the city. They will hold their next meeting tonight, and some St. John's residents plan to attend to voice their opposition to the tree removal. The meeting is open to the public and will take place at the University of Portland Child Center at 5000 North Willamette Boulevard from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m.
This week, Commissioners Amanda Fritz and Dan Saltzman wrapped up a series of task force meetings about Fritz's proposed mandatory sick leave policy. There are still a number of questions about how the policy will work. The task force, which includes business owners and representatives of advocacy groups, met regularly over the last 3 weeks to discuss the details. The ordinance currently requires that private employers in Portland give employees up to 40 hours of sick leave each year. Employees who work at least 240 hours a year would be eligible to earn 1 hour of sick leave for every 30 hours worked. Businesses with at least 6 employees would have to offer paid time off, while smaller companies could provide unpaid leave. The task force covered some tough issues surrounding the proposal, including whether the state's Bureau of Labor and Industries could realistically enforce the ordinance. The task force also discussed how the ordinance would affect specific types of businesses, such as truck drivers, and whether there should be certain exemptions made for new businesses. The City Council will hear testimony on the ordinance for the second time next Wednesday, and a final vote is expected in March.
The union representing Boeing's engineers and technical workers delivered a split decision on the company's contract offer Tuesday. The union's larger group of engineers accepted the proposal, but its smaller group of technical professionals rejected the offer and approved a future strike. The members of the Society for Professional Engineering Employees in Aerospace voted in two groups. The union will ask Boeing to resume negotiations on a contract that the technical employees would find acceptable. Boeing's offer provided for 5% average annual salary increases for both engineers and technical professionals for 4 years, no new increases in employee health care contributions, and an increase in the basic pension benefit. The union focused on a provision that would replace the pension benefit for new employees with a 401k retirement plan. The union says would pay 40% less income during retirement. Boeing differs with the union on the estimated financial impact, but says it must reduce the cost of pension benefits to remain competitive. The two sides began talks in April of last year, and existing contracts expired at the end of November.
U.S. immigration officials last night detained a Palestinian filmmaker whose film is under consideration for an Academy Award. Imad Bernat was detained at the Los Angeles airport last night, along with his wife and his 8-year-old child. The co-director of Five Broken Cameras was traveling to the U.S. to attend the Oscars. His film is nominated for Best Documentary. Bernat's film chronicles life in the Palestinian village of Bilayin during the ongoing protests against Israeli settlement expansion in the area. Here's a clip of Bernat speaking recently on the Laura Flanders Show.
When the decision been taken to construct the wall on our land, and when the route was routed to where to be the route and in the middle of our land, so we thought that 55% of Bil'in land will be taken to the other side, so we lose all of our lands, all of our trees. So we decided in the village, first time when they came with the bulldozer, everybody in the village came out and they started to protest and to demonstrate against the bulldozer and against the Israeli soldiers who just protect the bulldozer to uproot the trees and to destroy the olive trees and to destroy the land. And it was not a decision, like it's not was not political decision or was not organized. So everybody came out and they just decided to demonstrate. In the beginning, we were going on every day against the bulldozer and against the construction. So we thought we have to be to organize this and to be organizing more events and actions, not just demonstrations. So the village were supported by activists from all the world week after week. And so the creative of the ideas of the nonviolence resistance, it's more important that pay attention for the Bil'in village and the struggle in Bil'in village. So we were creating every week a new idea about nonviolent resistance and actions, not just demonstrations. So this ideas drew more people and more media to be and to participate and to focus on Bil'in village.
That was Palestinian filmmaker Ahmad Bernat. While in custody, Bernat texted his friend Michael Moore, also a documentary filmmaker, who began to publicize Bernat's plight. ICE officials didn't believe Bernat when he produced his invitation to the Oscars ceremony. They allegedly told him that he was a liar and that they were sending him back to Palestine. Eventually, lawyers from the Academy called the immigration authority on Bernat's behalf, and he was eventually released. If Bernat's film wins for Best Documentary, he will be the first Palestinian filmmaker to win an Oscar.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News after this local newscast, followed by Occupy Radio at 6. Tonight's show will take a look at the 1 billion rising movement to stop violence against women. In addition, we'll hear about Portland Rising Tide's occupation of the Oregon Historical Society to bring attention to the involvement of local company ESCO in the Keystone XL pipeline. At 7, it's Black History Month special with Sequoia Wright. And tomorrow's weather is rain with a high of 46 degrees Fahrenheit.
It's 5:15. Time now for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
As one who's been there, I can tell you that being unemployed is punishment enough without having a pack of ideologically hidebound legislators snarling, snapping, and ripping at your meager rations. Welcome to North Carolina, where the Republican-controlled legislature and their governor have gone after the state's hard-hit unemployed people like howling mad dogs. In a state with the fifth highest unemployment rate, now at 9.2%, these tar heads have slashed the lifeline of 500,000 people struggling to hang on to their middle-class possibilities. It's not like North Carolina's benefits were at all luxurious before this assault on them. Benefits were only $535 a week, but now they've been whacked to $350. Try to cover even life's basics, rent, utilities, food and clothing, and gas for job hunting on $1,400 a month. Plus, in their wisdom, the right-wing Solon slashed the weeks of eligibility for jobless aid from 26 to as few as 12. After that, adios chump, says the GOP, trying out its new Spanish-language appeal to Latino voters. By cutting the weeks so low, the GOP geniuses tripped over their own extremism, for that disqualifies 170,000 North Carolinians from the federal program of extended benefits needed by those suffering from long-term unemployment. This stumble will cost the state's economy about $780 million. That's interesting because the Republican rationale for going after so many vulnerable families was, one, that the deep cuts would pay down the state debt, and two, that they need to shrink government to make North Carolina's economic climate more attractive to business. This is Jim Hightower saying, stupidity aside, how can an entire party have strayed so far from common Sunday school morality and plain human decency as to cater to corporate interests on the backs of the jobless? To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Police arrested 10 environmental activists yesterday at a fracking wastewater disposal site in Ohio. Demonstrators were able to block truck shipments of toxic waste from entering the facility for 5 hours by erecting a 30-foot tower, which one of the protesters climbed. All 10 activists have been released on bail, totaling over $3,500. The company running the disposal, Wells Green Hunter Water, is seeking a permit from the U.S. Coast Guard to transport fracking wastewater by barge on the Ohio River. Environmentalists are concerned about an accident leading to toxic pollution. According to the group Appalachia Resist, over 100 people were at the blockade. Those arrested were charged with trespassing. The protester who climbed the tower was also charged with resisting arrest.
Coming on the heels of ex-LAPD officer Christopher Dorner's violent rampage, LAPD Chief Jarley Beck says he will reopen the case that prompted Dorner to resign. Rachel Miro and Erica Aguilar of the California Report have more.
After the fiery standoff that finished ex-cop Christopher Dorner last week, LA's police chief says he intends to follow through on his pledge to reopen the case that forced Dorner out of the LAPD. Erica Aguilar of KPCC reports.
Fired LAPD officer and Navy reservist Christopher Dorner raised allegations of departmental racism and a code of silence that has haunted the Los Angeles Police Department since the late 90s of the Rodney King era and beyond. The city's police chief, Charlie Beck, has promised full public disclosure into a reexamination of Dorner's firing on misconduct charges.
Just like it's important that the public has faith in the police department, it's important that the police department has faith in its own discipline system. And that is fair, and that is equitable.
Beck says he needs the case to be biopsied, even though Dorner's now dead, so he'll know if and where changes need to be made in department procedures. Chief Beck says the Dorner case has brought him closer to his officers. One of those officers, LAPD Captain Philip Tingarides, joined the chief yesterday. For 6 days, he and his family hunkered down at their home surrounded by armed police with rifles. Dorner had listed the captain as one of his targets because he chaired the 2008 disciplinary panel that led to his dismissal. Tingarides says he has new empathy for the people in the rough South LA community he polices.
Some of the talk in the community and that we've heard is, well, you know, how come they were hunkered down? He talks about being courageous and facing criminals all the time as community members. But why is he hunkered down? Now he knows how we feel. That's absolutely true.
Chief Beck says he expects the first part of the review of Dorner's firing would be done by the end of the month, but it could be weeks later until the Inspector General, the Police Commission, and finally the public can weigh in. For the California Report, I'm Erica Aguilar.
An action marked as the largest U.S. protest against climate change to date received little coverage from the mainstream media this week. 10,000 people marched on Washington to protest the Keystone XL pipeline that would deliver tar sand oil from Alberta, Canada to U.S. refineries on the Gulf of Mexico. Activists argue that the carbon-intensive project would only exacerbate the climate crisis, helping to extract and burn some 170 billion barrels of oil and threaten over other climate catastrophes. The television newscasts made just passing references to the historic march. ABC World News gave the protest 43 words and CBS Evening News 49. The longest report was on NBC Nightly News, which gave the protest 63 words. The CBS report did find time to assert that the pipeline would create 20,000 jobs. This is an estimate that pipeline proponents have touted, while other estimates, including one by the U.S. State Department are much lower. The New York Times only covered the protests as part of a story in the business section on the political ramifications of Obama's pending decision on the pipeline, with a small mention of Sunday's historic protest.
After watching the movie Lincoln, Dr. Ranjan Batra at the University of Mississippi Medical Center investigated what happened in each of the states after the ratification of the 13th Amendment. He discovered that the amendment was ratified in 1995, but since the United States archivist was never notified, it never became official. Batra spoke with his colleague Ken Sullivan about his discovery. Sullivan said he remembered when the state voted for the ratification, and Sullivan then obtained a copy of the resolution that passed the Mississippi Senate and House and contacted Secretary of State Delbert Hoseman. Hoseman filed the paperwork on January 13th. On February 7th, Hoseman was contacted by Charles A. Barth of the Federal Register to announce the official ratification of the 13th Amendment.
Large corporations such as GE and Microsoft have been registering their corporate headquarters in offshore tax havens like the Cayman Islands in order to avoid paying U.S. taxes. This practice, known as inversion, allows the largest American corporations, in some cases, to pay no taxes whatsoever while still reaping huge profits from products sold in the United States. While two bills are being discussed in Congress, little definitive action has been taken on this issue. Many of these corporations have lobbyists to Congress and are also instrumental in funding congressional campaigns. National advocacy group USPIRG is launching a campaign calling for an end to tax loopholes that allow this sort of corporate behavior. For more on this story, KABU reporter Jennifer Kemp spoke with Dan Smith, tax and budget advocate for USPIRG.
How do corporations use offshore tax havens to avoid paying U.S. taxes? What legal loopholes are in place allowing them to do so?
The way these companies do this is they take profits that they legitimately made right here in the United States with the benefit of our educated workforce, our large markets, our infrastructure. And they use a lot of sophisticated accounting gimmicks to make it look like they made the profits in a tax haven like the Cayman Islands. There's a single building in the Cayman Islands that is home to nearly 19,000 corporate headquarters.
And so this is something that large corporations do that small corporations can't do?
Exactly. So the most recent research is that 83 of the top 100 publicly traded corporations use tax havens. But if you're a small business owner, one, you don't have the armies of tax lawyers and accountants that it takes to use these kind of accounting gimmicks. GE, for example, that has 14 subsidiaries in tax havens, has almost 1,000 people working in its tax department. So its tax department ends up being a profit center for GE, which paid nothing in taxes for a three-year period.
You mentioned in the press release the term inversion. Can you explain what that means?
Sure. So inversion is the most extreme form of offshore tax dodging, where a U.S. company literally re-registers itself in a P.O. box in a tax haven. The good news is there have been some recent reforms that kind of take that the most stark form of offshore tax dodging up off the table. The problem is companies continue to use, you know, hundreds of other loopholes that allow them to dodge an estimated $90 billion in taxes every single year. And we're advocating to close all those loopholes.
And so you mentioned that Congress has not taken action on this particular issue. In your opinion, why not? Is this a political issue for Congress members?
Sure. And, yeah, the one thing I'll say is that there are a couple bills in Congress. There's legislative language out there ready to be passed that would close the most egregious tax loopholes. So there's the Cut Loopholes Act introduced by Senator Carl Levin, and the Corporate Tax Fairness Act introduced by Senator Sanders. So the legislation is there, but you're right, Congress has not taken action. And I think a big reason for that is how much lobbying these corporations do for their loopholes. We found in an earlier study 30 corporations that paid more money to lobby Congress than they paid in taxes.
Okay, so you think that Congress members are reluctant to pass action on this because they're being lobbied so hard by these very corporations, and perhaps even their own campaigns might have been funded by such corporations?
Right. You know, these are the biggest corporations in the country. They use a lot of scare tactics with members of Congress, and you know they have a lot to gain from using these loopholes. You know, the problem is that tax dodging, it's not a victimless offense. It's not just these corporations benefiting, but the rest of us who don't use these loopholes end up having to pick up the tab. If corporations aren't paying, then the rest of us see either higher taxes, cuts to vital public services, or more debt.
What type of action does U.S. PERC think that Congress needs to take on this issue of corporations evading taxes?
Congress needs to pass clear legislation that ends all of these incentives to put money offshore and close the loopholes. So the simple answer is, if we close the loopholes allowing the largest corporations, I'm talking about GE, Wells Fargo, Microsoft, Pfizer, to name a few, then it will raise critical revenue at a time when Congress is looking to cut important public programs.
Thanks so much, Dan, for taking the time to speak to me today.
Sure. Thanks for having me on, Jennifer.
This is Jennifer Kemp with KBOO News.
Journalists working for the British Broadcasting Corporation went on a 24-hour strike on Monday against job cuts. It was organized by the National Union of Journalists after a disagreement about decisions by top management about budget cuts. The BBC is primarily funded by a mandatory annual fee from households that own color television sets. A government freeze on this fee has caused the BBC to make financial changes. The BBC is planning on 2,000 compulsory redundancies over the course of the next 5 years, or layoffs, in other words. The NUJ has argued that the BBC is sacrificing quality journalists and wasting public money on the layoffs. At the same time, the BBC is advertising job vacancies. The BBC argues that the job cuts are necessary to balance the proposed budget.
Airports across Malawi are closed today as airport workers join a nationwide strike. Government employees, teachers, and now airport workers are all on indefinite strike to protest low wages and the devaluation of the nation's currency. The Associated Press reports that some public servants were given raises last year, but these were not enough to offset recent financial reforms, which have increased the cost of living. Malawi's currency was devalued last May by nearly half in an attempt to stimulate the economy. The unpopular financial reforms were backed by the International Monetary Fund and other international donors. Workers' unions are asking for a 67% increase in wages, as well as more equal pay for employees of the same grade in different departments. Malawi's finance minister says the government cannot afford the increased wages, claiming that meeting all the workers' demands would require the entire national budget to be spent on wages. The situation could continue to degrade as nurses and doctors have threatened to join the strike. This would essentially shut down the already short-handed hospitals. The civil servant trade union says they will only return to negotiations if the leader of the government's negotiating team is removed. This could lead to delays in resolving the crisis.
The United Arab Emirates became the first Middle Eastern country to purchase aerial drones from an American company. The United Arab Emirates has signed nearly $1.5 billion in defense contracts, according to that country's military. These contracts bring the UAE drones, mine-resistant all-terrain vehicles, and other weapons. The deal was announced yesterday at IDEX, a defense industry show held in Abu Dhabi. The largest purchase was for nearly $400 million of all-terrain vehicles. The UAE also paid $200 million to U.S. private company General Atomics for an undisclosed number of unarmed Predator drones. Other contracts included over $100 million with Raytheon for bomb parts and nearly half a billion dollars for aircraft maintenance.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, Afghan and NATO officials have confirmed that 25 Taliban insurgents and three commanders were killed in separate operations across the country. One of the Taliban leaders was Mohammed Akhund, who was killed in a precision airstrike in Helmand province. A Haqqani network facilitator was also arrested in Kandahar province earlier today.
800 Palestinian prisoners went on a hunger strike yesterday in solidarity with four other inmates who've been on hunger strikes for several months. Samer Essawi has been on hunger strike for over 210 days in protest of his detention without charge or trial. An Israeli court ruled yesterday that he would be held for at least another month with no charges filed. Allison Weir of the group If Americans Knew says that Essawi is near death already.
He has been taking water. Up until recently, there was a time that he stopped taking the water, so I don't know if he still is doing that. This is not the longest hunger strike ever. Apparently, there have been other longer ones. It's a little hard to compare because, as you've noted, whether someone takes water or vitamins, whether they're force-fed or not, it's sometimes hard to compare these. It's a little bit like apples and oranges. But his is definitely one of the longest, and it seems to be approaching what are considered the longest hunger strikes ever.
That was activist Allison Weir speaking about Palestinian prisoner Samer Essawi, who is on his 210th day of a hunger strike. The Solidarity hunger strike began today as protesters demonstrated in Ramallah, the second day of mass protests against what Israelis call administrative detention or holding prisoners without charge.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, February 20th, 2013. Palestinian man dies of wound.